podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Tony Review system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. We've got loads to get through on today's end of season show, including mulling over all of our moments of the season. I'm Yaz Rana and today I'm joined by the Wisden Cricket Monthly magazine editor, Joe Harmon, the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker, and the managing editor of Wisden.com, Ben Gardner. Loads to get through today. Let's start with Moeen Ali's retirement from the Test game. I spoke to Mark Butcher earlier about Moeen calling it a day and how his Test career should be remembered.
Moe's Test career was like a highlights reel, wasn't it? You know, when you think of Moeen Ali, you think of best shot of the day, brilliant, you know, some brilliant delivery that the pitch is 2 foot outside off stump, bowls Kohli through the gate. You think of that being followed up with the odd hip high full toss or having a huge mow at one and skying it straight up in the air at an inopportune moment. There was no in between. There was no boring dullness with Moeen Ali. And I think that's one of the reasons why people loved watching him play so much. There was a sort of a freedom in the way that he expressed himself on the field that probably belied a lot more in the way of seriousness, underneath the surface. But, 195 wickets for somebody who came in as who was a fill-in off-spin bowler, really, in Test match cricket is extraordinary. And the fact that he took them at 37 apiece kind of backs up the bit that I said before, you know, about the fact that he was either absolutely sensational and irresistibly good or was pretty damn ordinary. And I'll tell you what, I wouldn't have minded being remembered like that either. Just a compelling cricket player who, you know, perhaps if he hadn't have been quite such a sort of easygoing, mild-mannered sort of fella, it might have not been so easy for him to have been shunted around and used in so many different roles as a batter. But no, I think he can be very proud of what he achieved as a Test match player. And there'll always be lots of ifs and buts, you know, if he'd been given more of an opportunity up the order, if England had perhaps not had to rely on him at times as a holding spin bowler, which he never really managed to nail down in terms of a role, then his career might have been better. But in the end, I think he can look back on it and say he did pretty bloody well.
As you said, he did fulfil a lot of roles for England over the years. Do you think he should have got more opportunities batting in the top six? That was what he got in the team for in the first place. He batted everywhere from 1 to 9, which he's one of only two players in the history of the game to do that. And he kind of intimated that he was frustrated a little bit that he didn't get as many opportunities as he could have done. If you kind of think back to that era of the Bayliss era, you had loads of guys who wanted to bat six or six was their best position. So do you think in hindsight he got around about the fair number of opportunities in the end?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's an impossible one to answer because, as you rightly say, at that time, England had a lineup where you could say they had four number sevens in the team, of which Mo was one. It was a nonsense that he ended up batting at three or opening the batting at times. I mean, that should never have happened. And yeah, his natural home, I think, in a Test match lineup would have been anywhere between 5 and 7. Hmm. And then he can go out and play in the free manner. Well, I mean, that depending on how many runs the people above you have made, the free manner that suits him the best. Look, I don't know. I always find it difficult because in the end, the thing that kept Moeen in the side was his bowling. Mm. So the issue for Moeen always was that as a bowler, he was never able to be as consistent as a real frontline spinner might have been. So, you know, he could never bowl as consistently as Graham Swan. He could bowl better deliveries than Graham Swan. He could bowl, you know, similar wicket-taking stuff to Graham Swan, but he could never sort of be part of a four-man attack, say, with three quicks and one spinner, because he was never able to bowl consistently tight enough to do that. And so in the end, his fortunes as a bowler almost dictated what happened to him as a batsman. And you would argue that if he hadn't have been an effective wicket-taking off-spin bowler, he might not have got a chance to play on the side at all. So, you know, it's one of those things where there are all kinds of things in the pot that went towards how Moeen and his test career played out. And in the end, look, I have no absolutely, you know, some people are sort of saying, oh, he's chucked the towel in too early. I don't have any feelings about that one way or the other. I think he's very happy in the choices that he's making. I think he's in a very happy place as a cricket player and as a role model and all the other roles that he fulfills that are way beyond stuff that happens on the field. And that he's, you know, he's looked back at that career and gone, you know what, I've done very, very well indeed. And I'll be remembered as one of England's best all-rounders.
I'm going to reel off a few stats. 64 tests, 500s, 195 test wickets, 6 player of the match awards, the same number as Flintoff from 15 fewer tests in all but two of his years, 2015 and 2021, in the test side. He either averaged above 45 with a bat or below 32 with a ball. Under Joe Root's captaincy, he took 97 wickets at 31. Under Alistair Cook's captaincy, he averaged more than 35 with a bat. Joe, how are you going to remember Moeen's test career?
Fondly, for the main part. It's interesting you pick out those numbers because he's always been one of those players, particularly in test cricket, where you can pick the numbers that suit you. There's also some less flattering numbers you could pick out, particularly related to his batting over the last few years. But he gave a really honest, typically honest interview to Cricinfo announcing his retirement. Yeah, it left me feeling a bit sad. There is a sense that I think his view was that he's probably overperformed with the ball and underperformed with the bat. And I think it's kind of hard to argue with that, given some of the innings he played early in his test career, that there could have been so much more. And you can argue the toss, whether that's England have messed him around. I think that's definitely contributed to it. But he's got to take some responsibility for that himself, I think. But it's his bowling that's really, I think, history will judge him well on that, in a way that people have been quick to leap on a bad test. Whenever Moeen has a bad test with the ball, it shows that he's not good enough, which is just nonsense when you look at the record that he's put together. And what we regarded him as when he first came into that side, when it was that New England team, and he arrived with, I remember we did a cover for our old magazine, All Out Cricket, back in the day. It was him, Gary Balance and Sam Robson were the three coming men of English cricket at that point. And look, you look at those three careers that those guys have had, and Moeen was a great pick. The others had their moments, but we didn't pick him out as a test all-rounder. We picked him out as the most exciting batsman in the country at that point, who might bowl a few overs. As it is, he's got a record which very few can match, not in England, not just in England, but across the board as a test all-rounder. So, yeah, I think as the years go by, I think we'll look back on his test career perhaps more positively than people do now.
Phil, you can kind of manipulate the stats one way or the other to kind of put your own narrative on Moeen's career. But if you're playing for a cricket team and at the end of the season you're looking back at who are your players of the season, you don't go to play cricket first and look who tops the averages. You think about who won you games, who played shots or delivered balls that other players couldn't really do. And on that metric, Moeen features very highly.
Yeah, for 3 or 4 years, from that time he came in and was almost a victim of how naturally talented he was with the ball, to around 2017, 2018, for that 3 or 4 years, he was a dreamboat of a cricketer. And until he went to Australia that fateful winter and it all fell apart. And I don't think he ever really recovered from that. I don't think he recovered his self-esteem as a test match cricketer as well. And then, of course, there were off-pitch shenanigans regarding contracts and not really feeling trusted by the management and so on and so on. Plus, of course, let's not escape the fact that his T20 reputation was soaring as well. And he was making good money on the side of that. But anyway, for those 3 or 4 years, he was a a joy to have in that England side. And it was discovering itself as well, that side, at the time. If you remember, post Peterson, post that Ashes 13-14 horror show, he emerged alongside Stokes and one or two others into the kind of, history repeats itself all the time, into an England team that wasn't really sure of itself, was trying to forge a new identity and so on. And he was absolutely key to that. The game that always sticks out for me, actually, and I just looked it up just now, was the Cardiff game, 2015. Now, England went into that summer as underdogs against Australia. And they went to Cardiff and they batted first, and Joe Root got dropped second ball and then strummed 100, obviously. Sorry, shouldn't use that word anymore. And then Moeen came in with the game kind of, you know, on a bit of a knife edge first innings. And he hit 77 in, I've got it here, 77 in 88 balls, 11 fours and a six, and changed the complexion of that game, and then picked up five wickets. You remember he picked up Steve Smith as well in that first innings as well. He picked up five wickets in the game. England won that game. And then fast forward to 6 weeks or so, and Cook is at Trent Bridge in tears saying, "I never thought we could win this series." So much of that was down to the triumvirate of Root, Stokes and Moeen. Very, very different characters, very, very different blokes, but joined by a kind of sense of style and a sense of kind of showmanship in their own way. Moeen had that. He was not just immensely watchable, but he had the results as well. He had the numbers to back it up. It's interesting that you say maybe in time people will consider more fondly his Test career. I think they already are. I was actually quite surprised by the not the depth of feeling for him, but the words that people were using, you know, seasoned scribes and gnarled judges saying, great career. Well, it's not a great career. And there is that sense that he left a few out there. But then you take that compromise, or you take that, it's overcompensated by the fact that he was so immensely watchable and he did win you games of cricket, which was the original point. It was so frustrating here at the Oval, right, where he played so beautifully. This was, I'm talking last month, for 37, 38. And then Toad went up in the air. And, you know, we all look around and we all say, well, it's Mo, bless him. But that's the other side of Moeen Ali, in a nutshell, that innings, because he played some shots that, I was here, we were all here, never forget those shots, on the up with those high hands, standing tall, he hits the ball in peculiar areas for Test match players. He hits it kind of straight extra cover, not kind of to the right hand of extra cover, because he sees it earlier and he has such beautiful natural timing. And then out of nowhere, and the ball wasn't turning, and it was day two, and everyone was feeling good about life, and he just towed one up in the air for no reason at all, because that's Mo. And if we are looking at his career dispassionately, then there are a lot of those moments as well. It was interesting that he said in his interviews that his head wasn't really in it. He couldn't sustain that concentration for 5 days. And it had shown, hadn't it? It had shown for two or three years. He'd become more mercurial the older he got rather than less. He almost knew his way around the Test match game more as a 27-year-old than he did as a 32-year-old. But yeah, what a joy to watch him on his day. And obviously, he stood for so much more than the mere cricket.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm brown. I remember, I think it's broadly fair to say that when I was growing up, if you saw a brown man on the news, it generally wasn't for a very good reason. And I think that Moeen played a really important role in English cricket, having a positive British Asian role model. Ben, have you got a favourite Moeen memory of his Test career?
Yeah, well, I guess. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, in a way, he was diminished after that 2017-18 Ashes, but that's also when he had his best spell as a Test bowler, from his recall in Southampton to the first Ashes Test next year, or whatever it was, when he obviously struggled and was dropped, and then that was a contract thing, whatever. But between, I think he took more wickets than any other bowler in the world in that 12 months. And it would be, I guess it would either be that Southampton Test where he came in with the series on a knife edge and sort of bowled brilliantly through the game, and that was just Moeen ripping it and attacking, and I think it helps almost having Adil Rashid in the side and that he wasn't the only spinner. Or it would just be like kind of that whole Sri Lanka tour when he bowled like almost as well as any English spinner has overseas, I think. He was just
I don't dispute any of that, but it was the self-esteem that I think.
Yeah,
was
no,
hit
especially
so much.
As a batsman.
He,
yeah,
he always saw himself as a batsman
who
bowled by accident. And he was so naturally good at it. I remember Graham Swann saying he rips it because he was never coached. He didn't bowl spin as a young lad, so he wasn't through the pathways and he wasn't overcoached and so on. So there was a rawness to it. But as a batter, he never recovered from that tour, from being beaten up that winter.
Yeah,
but you're right about as a bowler that year, he was unstoppable.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And it's funny to think about when he first came into the side as a bowler, like he was almost picked to face Sri Lanka because he had a doosra. If you remember, and then he's bowled a sum total of one, I think, in an England shirt to Jai Wardner on that first day. And Jordan passed it back and said, well bowled, and then that was it, that was done. He wasn't going to bowl one again and risk that, I think. You talk about the match winning thing. I think we found a stat that I think only two English bowlers have more fourth innings wickets in wins, which is Broad and Anderson. And you consider how many wickets he's got overall, the fact that he got so many of those clutch moments shows something. And in terms of him being messed around, obviously, there's the contract thing, but this is a piece that Taha wrote for Wisden.com, just reflecting on Mohi's career. The last test of 2016 against India, he makes 100, batting a number four, his second 100 of the series. You think that here is a test batsman. First test the next summer, he's back down at number seven to fit everyone else in. And I think Mohi, I think, sums up this generation of England in test cricket and perhaps overall, where you've had a lot of these cricketers, him, Stokes, Butler and Bairstow, who England have wanted to fit in, even though they don't all fit in together, basically, but have like accommodated everything else kind of around them. And that goes for accommodating each of them around the other. And Mohin often was the one to lose out and move up and down. And these were cricketers who often ODI cricket was taking precedence because England were putting so much stock into winning that World Cup. And they were all cricketers capable of their moments and obviously still are in Stokes as one who's gone on to forge a properly great test career. And the others, you wouldn't quite say that, but they're also watchable. And also, as much as you might look at each of them and say they might have done more and are all maybe now coming to the end of their test careers to some extent, they also did. Like, England were a pretty good side in that time. I mean, you know, there were lots of ups and downs and lots of sort of questions and what ifs and stuff, but it was also a brilliantly watchable side and a side that has better results than people give them credit for. England haven't been hopeless in tests for 5 years. They've been up and down. They've had some very memorable results away from home and some big defeats as well. But Mohin and Bairstow and Butler and Stokes are part of that all for better and worse, I think.
Also, there's been a narrative with Mohin that his versatility hamstrung him, you know, that he would get moved around the order too much as a consequence of his all-round abilities. But I'm not sure if that really applies. I don't think Mohin Ali was ever a top six test match batsman. I don't think he could play the quicks with enough confidence regularly enough to be a top five, top six test match gnarled batsman. And when he did bat in four or five, it kind of showed, really. You know, the average was tottering around that late 20s, early 30s mark, which is not quite what you need from a top five, top six player. But the fact that he had all the rest of it enabled him to, I think, prolong his test match career. Remember, he came into the game as a batsman. That was how he saw himself. That's what he was. He could have been a one-day player, whether he bowled or not, I think. Marvellous one-day player. But I don't think there was really a top five, top six batter in there consistently enough. In spinning conditions, when you have to play through and so on, for sure. But I don't think that it was there for him purely as a batsman. So if anything, I think the fact that he could do the rest actually prolonged his test match career. He played, 60-odd test matches? He says himself, I didn't think he'd play anywhere near that number.
Yeah, possibly. I do wonder if he'd been given, I mean, obviously this just could never
happen. You look at the average.
But if he had been given, basically that his test career just at number six as the prime rounder. Basically, Ben Stokes didn't exist and Mohin was England's prime rounder rather than having to shift down to seven and eight and up. I think.
But you're saying all rounder again. It's
yes, yeah, yeah. I don't think he could be any higher than six, but I think he could, like, you know, there was that in his second test match, that 100 against Sri Lanka, that I think there was, and I think that obviously the average ended up down at 28, but I think there is a world in which Mohin could have been England's number six and averaged 35 for that period of time, which would
which
have
he
been.
Did under
but not
Gattinsey.
Without, yeah. Not without that.
No, yeah. sure, but as you ran, but the issue was you have those four players, all of whom are wanting to bat five or six really, and then you end up shoving one of them up to number three or one of them down to number eight, and then that doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm just looking at his numbers now. So his best position,
it's number seven, right?
Number seven by quite a long way. So three of his 500s were from number seven. His record at six was actually 344 runs at 21 from a reasonable sample size, which is quite interesting.
But the batting position doesn't reveal at all, does it? Because it was more that Moeen played different ways at certain points of his career, let alone where he was batting. There was a feeling at some points when he was at seven that he would play like a proper batter and could play as long as he needed to until he ran out of partners. Yeah. Towards the end, it was basically like he was just having a bit of a slog too often, really. And I think that comes back to what Phil said about that lack of self-esteem as a test match batter, that he just lost quite a bit of that and didn't really back himself to stick around for a long period of time, which was a real shame. And I think also a consequence of not playing any red ball cricket or much red ball cricket outside of test cricket. It was fine when he comes into the England test side and he's been batting three or four for Worcestershire and got well over 1,000 runs in the year before he got picked. He never really had that level of red ball batting once he started playing for England, and that's true for many cricketers, but it's a tough gig.
And we should also point out that he is in some ways slightly a victim of this schedule. I think in that interview with Cricket Info in the Garden, he said that he did look at that Australia tour also feeling like he had some unfinished business. In an ideal world, maybe he would have wanted to go there, see if he could still do it, but he's just saying that 4 month stretch, which would be, and you know, it's his choice to go to the IPL, and it's fair enough to make that choice, but having that and then T20 World Cup and then the Ashes would have been too much. And you realize if you're not willing to go to national tour, maybe that means that you should be just kind of that's it for you in test cricket. But if the schedule was different, he might have he might have made a different decision, I think. So
I think that's a record for us to go 20 minutes without mentioning the schedule show this summer. The County Championship is over and Warwickshire are champions for the first time since 2012 after a genuinely brilliant final round of games where at various stages four different sides were in with a shout of winning it. Lancashire beat Hampshire by one wicket at Liverpool, a crazy low-scoring game. Lancashire looked to be cruising it in the fourth innings, needing 19 runs to win with five wickets in hand. But Mason Crane made it a contest out of nowhere, taking 5 for 41 and effecting a run out with a direct hit, only for Dane Vilas to hit the winning runs to set off wild celebrations. My moment of the week, by the way, is Paul Allott celebrating in the Lancashire dressing room. Lancashire got a victory song and they're all like pumping their arms up, but Allott can't move his arms quite in sync with the rest of them. It's highly, highly recommendable. But from that point on, for Lancs to win, they needed Warwickshire to not beat Somerset on the final day. And at the start of day four, it didn't look that likely that Warwickshire would get that win. They started the day about 150 runs in front of Somerset, needing to set up a declaration before taking all 10 Somerset wickets on a pretty flat wicket. Rob Yates, the impressive 22-year-old opener, scored a free-flowing 100. Will Rhodes, the Warwickshire captain, then declared leaving Somerset a target of 273 with 79 overs left in the game, and Warwickshire ended up finishing the job early on in the third session. Joe, that was a really, really good end to the season, very entertaining.
It was fantastic. It was exactly what you'd want from the end of a county championship season, apart from it wasn't on telly for us to watch, which was a real shame. And now we've got the Bob Willis Trophy, which is a bit of a kind of damp squib of a match to finish the season, really. But it's a pretty astonishing achievement from Warwickshire, really, in that they didn't win a Red Bull game last summer. They would have got relegated the previous year, but for the fact that only one side went down from Div 1. I interviewed Paul Farbrace literally a few minutes before this podcast, and I asked him, did you think you had a realistic chance of winning it? He said, no chance, not at all. The aim was to get into Division 1, because he thought being in Division 2 or Division 3 wasn't going to be a good place for his young players to develop, but he didn't think they'd go on and win the thing, and he didn't think they would until the last couple of weeks. You look down their side, and it doesn't jump out as a championship-winning side necessarily. I mean, the batting unit, I'm watching Rob Yates just over your shoulder, kind of nearing a ton at Lords, and he looks like a really good player. He's not had a stunning season. He scored 400, which is excellent, but he's also had a lot of low scores.
Yeah, but big runs. I mean, he made that 100 against Essex in the fourth innings at Edgbaston, which was basically whichever team won that was going to go through. It was a brilliant 100, and I watched all of that. And as Yaz says, 100 last week as well. So, and that's the kind of stuff that people notice, you know, important runs rather than averages and so on.
Absolutely. I mean, there was an interesting one. They put up a stat yesterday that how many of his runs have come at Edgbaston as well. So that's another thing.
And in the second innings, which is Yeah. Quite strange.
I mean, yeah, you could say it's it depends which way yeah. you swing it, really. But I asked Farbrace about Yates, who spoke glowingly about him. He said he could be captaining Warwickshire now. He's that kind of character. He said technically he's good and he's improving, but he said he's a character that really stands out. He said he's badgering the England selectors. Well, I don't have any selectors today. I guess he's badgering Chris Silverwood to say, he's and has been for a while, so you've got to take a proper look at this guy. And I think, I mean, he'll certainly go on a Lions tour. There's an outside chance, depending on how big this Ashes tour is, that he could even be on that, I guess. That, looking at his overall record, that would seem a bit early. But yeah, he said, Farbrace said he expects... He said Yates would be captaining Warwickshire in 5 or 6 years' time, apart from the fact he thinks he'll be scoring runs for England. So he obviously has very high hopes for him. He picked out Liam Norwell as well. He said he absolutely deserves a Lions chance. I guess Craig Miles would probably be in the mix for that as well. But these are players who have been... Norwell and Miles, they've been around county cricket for a while. They're really, really good county bowlers. But you wouldn't have necessarily said those two guys are going to spearhead a championship-winning attack. Both from Gloucestershire, should be mentioned as well. Gloucestershire have done a lot in producing those players. And yeah, I mean, some might say that Warwickshire wouldn't have won the championship in a different season where you have the kind of usual structure. You know, that's the moot point. But it's certainly impressive. I think they've won 4 games, I think I'm right in saying that, in the last session of a match, which obviously shows a side with a lot of spirit, a lot of belief. And they're a young team who will only get better as well.
Mm. Ben, they've recruited very well out of the side that took the field on the final day. Sibley, Rhodes, Burgess, Bresnan, Briggs, Miles and Norwell have all been signed in the last few years. How do you feel about a club that recruits well? Because the implication is there that there aren't that many homegrown players in the team. There'll be Notts fans listening to this saying that they've received quite a lot of criticism for them signing players in recent years. Atherton on Sky last year was very critical of them. But I also think that with the exception of Miles and Norwell, that a lot of those guys weren't getting the game time they were hoping to get at their previous clubs, and that's why they moved on. So yeah, what do you think about a side that's based on good recruitment rather than homegrown players necessarily?
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is that they probably are paying players pretty well, but it doesn't seem like that's the reason why they're not just going to, you know, small clubs who have very good like sort of finished articles and like bring them in basically to sort of construct a counter cricket's version of the Galacticos or whatever. It's like with Dom Sibley, when he left Surrey, he was sort of batting at number 5 and 6 and he was playing the county championship, and that was obviously frustrating for him, was also in and out of the side. But then he went to Warwickshire, batting in the top 3. And
he's a top 3 batsman.
Yes, yeah, but and that's what he wasn't doing at Surrey though. Yeah. And so he was able to do that at Warwickshire and then is now playing for England. Danny Briggs wasn't playing championship cricket at all down at Sussex and is now getting to do that and is doing that very well. So I think they are sort of, it's not just, you know, they're not just hoovering up talent or stars. They are getting players who they think they can improve and doing that, which there is still a role for that, I think. And
I think
if we're realistic about what county cricket is going to be, I think players are going to want to move clubs like for any number of reasons. And I think that like if you start criticizing clubs just because they are getting players and giving them chances, and if we do go to some where there are 2 divisions, players are going to just want to play in the top division, because even if England are looking at all counts equally, which it doesn't seem like they are, they always do, even then like players want to win county championships, so you want to go to a side where you have the chance to do that. And I mean, it's just this kind of how the structure is going to work, that is going to happen. Sure, they might want to produce a couple more players of their own.
They are coming through as well. I think there is a difference in that. There was a sense that Notts had kind of neglected that side of things a little bit and were just focusing on just picking up the best talent. Whereas you look at Warwickshire, they've got some really good young kids coming through. I mean, Jacob Bethel, who I mentioned on the... I mean, albeit he was taken from Barbados, but he has been certainly developed at Warwickshire. Dan Mousley's another one. There's the Brooks brothers.
Jahal, who's played in this game, doing really well.
Yeah, there's Yates as well. So there is lots of young players. That's not being neglected at Warwickshire by any means. This is just the stage they're at. And, you know, rescuing a few careers and getting them a county championship, I think is a great thing that should be applauded, really. Just quickly as well, on Farbrace spoke about Bresnan, and he said, because I think they dropped Bresnan for the penultimate game, and he said that was a kind of stroke of luck in that it... Oh no, was it 2 games out? Anyway, he was dropped, and that, he said that was a stroke of luck because him not being there, they lost the game, and they realised how important Bresnan was, even though his stats this year aren't particularly good. He said in that young side, they really needed him there, and then brought him back in, and he's... they said he's been just absolutely integral as someone who's won the championship before, knows how to do it, knows his way around a crucial game and crucial moments in those games. So yeah, again, stats don't reveal everything. I think from what he was saying, Breslin's a really influential player in that squad.
So some brilliant catches at slip in that game as well.
Yeah, there was apparently he sent a text to Dom Sibley after he had been dropped by England, and obviously Sibley had been down the dumps, and Breslin texted him saying like, get your head on, we've got a county championship to win. And I guess it's that sort of thing.
One extra point, of course, is that it's an ongoing scandal that clubs are not fully compensated for developing young players and then being poached by richer clubs. I mean, this has not been properly addressed by, I was going to say the ECB, but the CEOs and the county chairman, how there can't be some recognition in a spirit of togetherness and altruism that the small clubs, and we are seeing more and more talent being funneled to clubs who can pay greater wages, and that's inevitable in the age of ultra-professionalism and so on and so on. But for these clubs not to be in any way compensated for that is a shocker. It's an absolute shocker. And you have a scenario where someone like Phil Salt learns his cricket at Sussex. They invest a lot of time and energy into his career, and then he gets to a certain age, just as he's bubbling, just as he's boiling there, and then he says, all right, I'm going to head to Old Trafford. Now, you don't knock the kid for doing it, but how there can't be some kind of parachute payment for the club that has invested all that time and energy into that player, I just find it an ongoing, bewildering scandal in our game that we don't have this, and we have to address it because this problem is going to become more and more pronounced.
Well, it's never felt more important.
Exactly.
Now. I mean, both of us beating the drum for it a few years ago when he took over at Durham as the chairman. But yeah, he made a good point then, and it's even more pertinent now, that especially with
totally
the Test grounds getting a bit more cash from hosting the 100 as well. I mean, the gulf is growing. And you're seeing that more and more clearly. That's something that needs to be resolved.
I mean, a real cynic would say that there are certain people sitting on that board with their own club's vested interests at heart who are not prepared to engage in that kind of conversation because it doesn't benefit them and it doesn't benefit the model going forward. I'm not that cynic, but there are certain cynics out there saying that.
Ben, Ollie Pope scored millions at the Oval. It scored 274, probably the most inevitable double hundred I've ever seen in a very, very high scoring game. You enjoyed watching him.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a bit of a fast and a strange way to end the season because Glamorgan made 650 for six declared, which was about 200 under par, I think. Chris Cook scored a double hundred and then ended the game bowling hooping in swingers as Glamorgan's 11th bowler.
As Michael Hogan, 40-year-old seamer, took the gloves, right? Yeah.
So, but it was still, I mean, I think because of the inevitability of it, it was quite nice to watch Pope's 100, just to watch him sort of toy with an attack like that on a pitch where he knew that he was going to be able to like just do whatever he wanted on, basically, and to, you know, they'd move the fielder a little bit square and he'd drive it straight, and then he'd move it slightly straight and he'd drive it squarer. And he'd, you know, sweep and dab the spinners and move it all around and just basically get, like, you wouldn't, like, be, like, and especially in that last year, there weren't a huge amount of people in, so you wouldn't be sort of getting your head lifted up by the applause or whatever. But he was just basically getting a boundary and over and just ticking along at 70. And it was just, it was the only thing that surprised me was that he didn't go on to a triple 100, basically.
Hamish Rutherford got his man.
Yeah, his first class wicket in his 115th first class game.
I turned up here on the morning of that final day pretty underwhelmed by the prospect of a day's play drifting, undulating out there meaninglessly at the Oval. The boy Gardner was slavering like a little puppy. He could not wait for the prospect of Pope's tilt at a triple 100.
But Pope and Hashim Amla,
absolutely wetting yourself, like, with excitement.
Pope and Hashim Amla just driving a limited attack on a very flat
pitch. Go watch that net. To be honest.
Yeah, but there is something nice about that, and it was pretty sunny last day of summer sort of thing. And also I think just as a wider point on Pope's career, obviously it's becoming more and more pronounced that difference between his record at the Oval and elsewhere. He's literally Bradman-esque at the Oval. He averages 99.94 there, and averages just under 40 everywhere else. But I do think that, like, not every player is going to average 99.94 at the Oval, so it's not as if that is nothing. I think that he's very, very good at cashing in on on flat wickets, and that is a
you
very
have a theory,
that, that is yeah, that is a valuable thing, and that there are, there are flat wickets outside of South London. Some of them might be there in Australia this winter, and not saying he's going to go out there and score 274 every time, but I think that that gives him the tools. And also, I mean,
you're right, you're absolutely right,
and it's
absolutely right.
It allows him to sort of groove a technique that's not just worried about how you're not going to get out, I think, but that does allow him to sort of like think about scoring each time. Which, if you are raised on a greener pitch where there's a ball that's going to be on, that will have your name on it, and all you're trying to do is lessening the chance that the next ball is that ball, that does mean that you end up with like a slightly weird amalgamation of a technique that's sort of a lot of moving parts and like answers lots of different questions and stuff, rather than just like almost like, how can I best position myself to like hit a boundary or and then not get out, basically.
Yep. I think that absolutely stands up.
And you made the point recently as well that in 2017-18 at Perth, England got 400 in the first innings, but that was about 200.
Yeah, like the Morgan's here, yeah.
Yeah. Ricky Clark played his final first-class game in that run fest. He finished his career with 22 England appearances, three-time county championship winner, nearly 18,000 runs, over 800 wickets, and nearly 600 catches across all formats.
Greatest second slip I've ever seen in English cricket, genuinely. Amazing second slip.
Literally buckets for hands, as Tim Murta says, I think. Which would have made his batting record particularly impressive if that was
We ran a little cartoon, didn't we, in that magazine that you mentioned earlier. Yeah, literal buckets.
Phil, what's your moment of the week?
The other end of the scale. Shortest championship game, shortest four-day championship game in history. Essex North Ants. Done and dusted about an hour into day two. 30 wickets fell in the game, 20 of which fell to Essex, and 10 of which fell to Sam Cook, who's one of the stars of the summer. He had, at the end of day one, 9 for 26 across two innings. North Ants, and I was there for day one, and they hadn't given up. They just didn't have any answers. And now the pitch was spicy, sure, but this was an eccentric game of cricket, to say the least. And one of many games that were done and dusted quite quickly towards the back end of the summer. I don't want to whinge on about pitches, although that's obviously an issue. It was more just the kind of chaos and carnage of an end of season. And from the home team's perspective, it just reinforced their frustrations, I think, with the season as it plays out. They're used to success. They haven't had any this year. The second division trophy, which there is actually a trophy for.
I saw a picture of,
right,
I think.
So I was speaking to the press boys there, and they were saying, we don't know what to do. Do we make a thing of this, or do we just pretend it hasn't happened and all of that? But yeah, North Ants started the season really well. They've got a lot of talent actually there. Vasconcelos is a brilliant player, but he bummed out both innings. I think they were all out for 80 and 40. Or something ridiculous.
Oh, Essex won by an innings and didn't get to 200.
Essex got 170, yeah, and won by an innings quite easily. And yeah, their second innings, North Ants lasted 18 overs. 18.2 overs, to be fair. So yeah, shortest four-day game in championship history.
Hmm.
On counties not being sure how to celebrate dubious success, did you see Middlesex's account tweeting, just 8 wickets needed to win Division 3, which unfortunately they only got 6 of, because Kent chased down 370.
That was next on my list, that hashtag Super Kent added to their T20 Blast trophy with a Division 3
yeah.
title, the elusive double.
Famous double.
It was an amazing game though. They chased down 373 on the final day, and there was a 172 run stand between Ollie Robinson and Tawanda Muyeye, who a lot of people have been very excited about this summer, and this was kind of like his breakthrough knock against a good Middlesex attack. So that was good fun. We're recording the show on the second morning of the Bob Willis Trophy final. Day one belonged to Warwickshire, who rolled Lancashire over for 78 before ending the day on 120 for nothing. Had a couple of questions, including one from Joel Davison, essentially asking, what's the point of the Bob Willis Trophy?
Good point.
Here's Butch answering that question.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. I think the whole reasoning behind this was done with good intentions, you know, for last year anyway, for COVID year. But once the game was not there to decide who were county champions, because I think the counties said, and I kind of back them up on this in many ways, that you have a league and the league decides who wins it, not a sort of Sheffield Shield style final. Once that decision was made, it then sort of becomes, well, okay, well, what are we doing this for? So yeah, I mean, the best thing for it, I think, and the best thing because of the association with Bob and all the rest of it, would be to, instead of playing the Champion County versus the MCC, you play for the Bob Willis Trophy first v second as a curtain raiser to the championship season. However, of course, that is another week in the calendar that has been chewed up by something else, you know. Mm. So, you know, do you play it in March and try and do it overseas, etc.? I don't know. But this is because the end of the county championship season was so dramatic last week. You know, Lancashire thinking that they'd won it in that cliffhanger up at Egbeth, and then Warwickshire just playing the perfect game really to beat Somerset on the final day. You know, that felt like that should have been it. But, you know, neither of these two teams, I mean, Warwickshire, for example, I know this from having won a county championship and then had two or three championship matches left in the season afterwards, you kind of think, well, you know, the temptation would be just to you know, go on the smash and kind of not pay much attention to the last games, so that don't matter. But on the other hand, you're thinking, we are the champions. We want to show people that we are worthy of that tag, and we don't want to spoil the season by putting in a terrible performance in a game that might not mean a great deal, but still is a match there to be won. So I think there's some prize money on it as well, you know, and that's always quite a nice little thing at the end of the season. So I'm sure both teams are very much up for it. Whether or not the viewing public has any interest is another thing entirely.
Joe, you have strong thoughts on this.
Can't sleep at night.
Well, I haven't heard what Butch said, so I'm wary of just repeating him. You can edit me out if so. But yeah, it just struck me, first of all, with that press conference that we both found ourselves in with Will Rhodes, that was good organisation, wasn't it?
we all asked different questions.
Sure. Where he said a few of the Warwickshire players were grumbling after winning the championship that they had to have another game. Well, look, that's... He also said that when they arrived at Lord, they were up for it, but that's not really how you should feel about it. I'm just really glad that the game is going the way it has done, because if it had been Lancashire who won the toss and Skittle Warwickshire on the first day, it would have just been a really unfair kind of dampener to a really fantastic season for them, and that shouldn't be the case. So I was kind of up for a sort of trophy final potentially if it had been to actually decide the championship, so it, like the Sheffield Shield where the first two play off. I mean, I'm not wholly convinced by that, but that's got a lot more credence to it than this. Or potentially you move this game to the start of next season as the kind of Community Shield thing. Again, I'm not sure it's worth it, but that would make more sense than this game at the end, which doesn't really stand for anything. And apart from, obviously, it commemorates Bob Willis, but there are dozens of ways that could be done in, I think, a more effective and more fitting
it's
way.
It's such a delicious irony as well that it's the Bob Willis Trophy final when Willis was absolutely uncompromising in his belief that 18 counties were simply not fit for purpose and the county championship had to be pruned.
And he hated pointless cricket.
In order for the future of the game.
Hated pointless cricket. And this, yep. And this, to all intents and purposes, is, I'm afraid. I mean, yeah, Warwickshire fans, tell me otherwise. If you're excited about potentially winning this, then look, I'm...
Yeah. High charts, they might have already won this by the time this goes out.
But I somehow doubt that. I think they feel that the season has basically ended with the championship win on a high, and that should have been that.
Could I just add, I don't disagree with any of that. This game taking place beyond your shoulder is a horror show. It's awkward and a little bit embarrassing for everyone concerned. I'll give it one more year, though. In fact, I'll give it a week or two to find out what the Brains Trust... you can put inverted commas around that if you like, are going to come up with regarding next year's carve-up of the season. Now, I think we're going to do something on that possibly next week on the show. The CEOs of each county are meeting today, Joe. And we shall see by this time next week what they've come up with. I'm not completely discounting the possibility that a kind of subsidiary tournament alongside the championship could be something that could still find its way, wheedle its way in there into the summer, as possibly run at the same time as the 100 to give members that Red Bull cricket that they crave, and so on and so on. I haven't completely ruled it out, but it's on its last legs if it's going to be a repeat of what we've seen here. This obviously doesn't stand up. It's peculiar. It doesn't mean anything. But I can kind of understand why they've kept hold of it rather than bury it after one season. I'm not saying that they will come up with a solution that will work.
Yeah.
But
it was good.
I'd be interested to hear what they do say.
It was good in very different circumstances last year.
No, last year it worked really well.
When it was the actual
in
final.
In weird times.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And there is some value in that, in having a showpiece game on TV at the death, for sure. But it's not beyond the will of the ECB and Sky, who do great things for the game, as we know, to come up with a scenario whereby, say, the two fixtures that are relevant at the end of the championship season, as Sky have done traditionally for the last few years, you get cameras to both of those games, and you show those properly and respect the final round of the championship, which didn't really happen.
Absolutely.
This year. And that was an awkward dud, I'm afraid.
Absolutely. You can't have a situation in the future where you have a game as good as Hampshire Lancashire, where, I'm sorry, but you actually couldn't see the stumps on one of the from one of the ends on the stream. The camera was too low, so the umpire was in the way. If you're going to have a finish that good, it needs to be in a presentable way.
Did you say, Ben, sorry, 16,000 were watching it on YouTube at the end, is that right?
At YouTube, right at the death, yeah.
Yeah, so you have this amazing finale, climax, and 16,000 are watching that.
Obviously, there are other places to watch it, other places to follow it. And
but you said that the majority seemed to...
I think so, yeah.
...filtered into YouTube, right? Yeah. You see, that's a derisory number of people who are following that. All right, they'll be following it in different ways for sure. But if that were on TV, then you'd have a damn sight more people aware of what was taking place.
On last week's show, Joe asked listeners to let us know what they thought, and we got quite a few emails in, a lot of different suggestions for how people want the first class summer to look like. They were sent to, as one listener described it, our shiny new email address, podcast@wisden.com.
Could I just say on this? Thrilled by the response
from
folks. Keep it coming. We're amazing. Very insecure over here. Keep it coming. It's done wonders for Joe's self-esteem.
He has, actually. You need is a kind of late season pickup.
Absolutely. And we do our best to reply to every single email as well. So do keep sending them in. I'm going to run through a few of the suggestions. As Phil said, we're going to talk about it in more detail on next week's show. Alex Rainbow suggested having three divisions of six, but not a conference system where the winner of Division One is your county championship winner. There's two up, two down across the divisions. And then the Bob Willis Trophy is a seeded knockout competition featuring the top 16 teams from the county championship. So two teams don't take place with a final at Lords. Sam Hare put together something similar to last season, a seeded conference system with the winners of each group and the top placed second team going into two semi-finals before a final to decide the winners. Luke Appleton suggested that the Bob Willis Trophy final should take place before the season, similar to the Community Shield in English football. So thank you very much for those. It really has been an excellent week in domestic cricket. The Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy final was a classic. The Southern Vipers retained their title, winning by three wickets with two balls remaining. Chasing 184, they were 109 for 7, having lost both openers for Ducks before Emily Windsor and Tara Norris put on 78 for the eighth wicket to see them home. Ben, you said the other day that the Vipers don't know when they're beat. They finished top of the group stage with 6 wins from 7. A lot of their wins were very close games. They beat the Sunrisers by 1 run, Thunder by 3 wickets. I spoke to Tara Norris earlier, one of the heroes on the day, about the final and also her international career. That is set to begin next month with the USA in a World Cup qualification tournament. I read that you got into cricket relatively late. How did you first come across the game?
Yes, I grew up in Spain and the US, so I had never heard of cricket. And it wasn't until, Chance to Shine came into my primary school at about 8 or 9 years old. They came in for some PE lessons, which I really enjoyed. They suggested I join the after-school club, which I did. And then they kind of pushed me through to my local club, where they said there's a girls team there, and it kind of just went on from there, really.
You had a really good season in 2021, came close to winning the 100, played a massive part in the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy final. This is your first year as a contracted professional. Can you give a sense of how much of a game changer 2021 has been for domestic players not in the England team?
Yeah, I think it's almost that stepping stone, and actually the volume that we've had all winter has just been incredible. I've never trained so much, I've never had so many games. This summer is the most cricket I think I've ever played, so it's been brilliant. And I think just to have that exposure as well, you look at the likes of, you know, Charlie Dean, Maya Boucher, both domestic players played for Southern Vipers. It just shows how England selectors are now picking players based on form, and they're actually looking at domestic games as well. They're not just looking at England players. So yeah, it's a massive confidence boost for the domestic players. And yeah, it shows that they're picking, you know, real talent, players in form. So yeah, it's fantastic.
How different was your winter going into this season to what it would have been like a couple of years ago, just to give a sense of like how much more cricket you'd have been playing?
Yeah, so I mean, I was at uni, so I was training quite a bit. I was on an MCC program, which was fantastic, at Loughborough University. But those players who weren't involved in that, they were having county training, you know, once a month on a Saturday for about 2 hours, and it would just be nets, really. So actually to have, you know, the likes of Charlotte Edwards coaching as well on a weekly basis, having purposeful training, the facilities we're at are incredible. And yeah, just that volume, which, you know, we've never been exposed to before, is just incredible.
How do you feel that you've improved as a cricketer in that last year or so?
Yeah, definitely. And not even, you know, skill-based, I think, yes, definitely. But just almost just having that exposure and that support and that contact time makes such a difference. You know, before I was seeing my Sussex coach once a month, once every 3 months when I was at uni. So just that contact time and having those regular conversations and training with people at the same level as you and higher standards just makes you a much better player. And those training standards just keep on lifting.
And then on the Vipers are 2 from 2 in the Rachel Hayo Flint Trophy. What do you think has been most important to your back-to-back successes?
I think Charlotte Edwards has a lot to do with that. The environment she creates is just incredible. It's a fantastic learning environment. It's very, very friendly, very encouraging, very supportive. And yeah, the environment that her and Gads have created is just brilliant. It's a really good atmosphere. And I think we just want to play for each other. We want to play for the Vipers. You know, we celebrate each other's success and it's, you know, it's incredible.
You've been selected to play for USA, I saw, in an upcoming World Cup qualifying event. How did that come about?
That happened to the 100, actually. Again, another really good broadcast of the 100 and that exposure for players, which I don't think I would have got previously. Yeah, I think they just saw sort of in my personal players page, born in US, just as a fun fact, really. And yeah, the head coach got in touch and within the space of about 10 days, they said, look, if you can get your passport renewed, we want you to come out and play for us in these competitions. So yeah, I went to the US Embassy a week later, got it all signed off. And yeah, I fly out next week. So I'm really excited. It'll be a fantastic opportunity.
Does that mean that you can you still play for England in the future?
Yeah, I think because it's not a test nation, it doesn't affect any eligibility. So yeah, it's pretty much a win-win.
England ended up beating New Zealand 4-1. New Zealand won the third game. Leah Tahuhu with a fifer there as New Zealand bowled England out of 178. Chase it down with 3 wickets in hand. England won the last 2 games with hundreds from Heather Knight and Tammy Beaumont. I thought the Knight 100 in particular and the fiddly run chase was sublime. Ben, the 5th game was really encouraging from an England point of view. They scored 340 odd. They won by 203 runs. And you saw the benefits of having a longer batting lineup there with Danny Wyatt smashing a 20 ball 43 not out from number 7. Is that the balance that you go for going ahead to the World Cup?
Yeah, it is. And that's also the game plan that England have been aiming for as well. They've kind of made a habit of being bowled out often for under par totals in ODIs, and sometimes their bowling has dragged them out of the hole, and occasionally it hasn't. But I think it's because they've been kind of aiming for something higher, sort of realising that if they're going to challenge Australia, they need to just like almost like be better as a batting lineup, aiming for those really big totals. So I think so, yeah.
And I guess it's interesting comparing it to the Australia series that we're going to talk about, is that the scores in this series until the last game were actually just noticeably lower than what was going on in Australia, India.
Yeah, and also, I mean, in this series, it was especially encouraging just how they accelerated right towards it. I mean, Wyatt was the star act, but there was a lot of them chipped in. Amy Jones chipped in. Sophia Dunkley, who's played all of England's games this summer, just looks absolutely at home in that sort of middle order, lower middle order role now. So yeah, that is really, really encouraging. And obviously, yeah, but yeah, you want, you know, a ton from one of your top three or top four, which they're all very capable of doing, and then those guys to put the finishing touches, and that's how you win a World Cup, hopefully.
Mm. Yeah. And even with Wyatt at 7, there's enough bowling there that England should be fine. Brunt, Eccleston, Shrubsole, one more, Nat Skiver, Heather Knight should cover the 5th bowling option if required.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not really almost the balance you'd go for if you were sort of like designing an ODI team, but that's because teams just don't expect to have the luxury of a player like Nat Skiver, who can be a frontline bowler. And Heather Knight also, her bowling is, she underrates her own bowler, I think. You could see, I mean, she did get 2 of her 3 wickets with sort of a full toss and a long hop, but I think she is good enough to be sort of like a 6th bowler. And I think England also, they will always need that. They can't be a 5 bowler team because Anya Shrubsole in particular I don't think very rarely bowls her full quota. So they need that sixth, sometimes seventh bowling option, but they also have it. I mean, you know, Wyatt has occasionally bowled. Dunkley can bowl a little bit of leg spin. They have other options as well. So
A frustrating series for Lauren Winfield Hill. She got in quite a few times. She got that 100 against England in a warm-up game early in the summer, but it's now 5 years since she got a half century in international cricket. I felt that was a really big missed opportunity to like properly cement her spot at the top of the order. I guess she probably still will for the World Cup, but you kind of worry that without another big score soon, England will look elsewhere after the World Cup.
You'd think so. I mean, she's got four scores above 20 in this series and didn't go past 44. And that is kind of the story of Lauren Winfield Hill's career, really, in that she's got, so she's been an ODI cricketer since 2013. And in only one of those years has she made a 50 plus score. And while for a while that was like, you know, she would contribute in like the last 2 years, she's averaged sort of like high 20s, and that would be enough to sort of like keep you in and around the squad. There wasn't a huge amount of people knocking on the door. Now there's loads of people knocking on the door, and there'll be more and more as the years go on. I mean, we've talked about Alice Capsey a lot, but I don't think it's out of the question that like pretty soon someone like that could come in and fill that role if she doesn't get a big score or a few big scores soon. So yeah, it's a huge winter for her. Yeah.
And finally, you wanted to comment on some comments made by Catherine Brunt earlier in the series.
Yeah, she I think it was before the fifth ODI, she gave a really, so she was rested for, she gave a really nice interview on Sky Cricket where she's really kind of seems, there's been times where she's been sort of a bit almost like terse and almost like the classic sort of grumpy northern fast bowler. But she seemed really at ease with herself, sort of trying to jokily sort of put off the retirement talk and all that sort of thing. But the one point she was making is that how the ODI series almost felt like a bit of a slightly low key end of the summer after the highs of the 100 because of sort of the settings they were playing at and therefore the attendances and that sort of thing. And I think there's been for quite a long time actually a sort of self-fulfilling, almost like defeatist attitude with women's cricket and attendances in England, in that if you play in smaller towns with smaller venues, you're going to get smaller crowds, and then you're going to feel that you can't justify having a game at a big crowd because you won't be able to get the numbers in. But if you play a game in London or in Manchester, there are loads more people there who might want to go to one. And I think it doesn't have to be every game. I think if you aim for having like maybe two games a summer at like the test match, two of the test match venues, and you just absolutely gear loads of marketing around that, that could be a real way forward and a way to ensure that the 100 isn't just a 3 week high for women's cricket, and then the rest of the summer it's kind of like something played in outgrounds and smaller county grounds, but something that like is sustained throughout the whole summer.
Yeah, well, that's the thing though. If you've got people watching women's cricket for the first time at the 100, they're at venues that aren't used for England games, and it's unlikely. You'd hope it happens in small numbers at least, but it's unlikely that someone who's started going to a few women's 100 games in London are going to go that far outside London to watch them. The Australia-India ODI series had a thrilling conclusion. Australia's winning streak is finally over, coming to an end after 26 wins in a row. The last two games were brilliant. Australia won the second game off the final ball in controversial circumstances before India won the finale by 2 wickets. Hulan Goswami hitting Sophie Molyneux for 4 down the ground the last over to seal a famous victory there. Ben, do you want to talk through the controversial end in the second game? Because that really was quite hard to follow for a bit.
Yes, yeah. So again, involving Goswami, who earlier in the over, so Australia was sort of, they were getting them in twos basically. They needed 13-20, I think, at the start of the over, to Nicola Carey, and Beth Mooney made a brilliant 100. But so early in the over, she'd bowled a beamer to Carey, which hit her on the grill, which is important later on. And then it comes the final ball. Australia need 3 to win, I think. And then she bowls again, another high full toss, not beamer, but a round waist high, basically, which Carey hits into the leg side. It's caught. And India think they've won. They celebrate wildly. And then there's a very lengthy no ball check. It's quite a complicated thing to do, actually, because it's about your waist position in your normal batting stance. And Carey, she's playing the shot, sort of crouches, and she also makes connection with the ball quite a long way in front of her. So I think Lisa Stelaker got her ruler out and was drawing lines basically on where the ball was. Yeah, basically, yeah. And it probably was just about the right call to have it be a no ball. But then you also have the question of, like, was it a dangerous high full toss, and should Goswami then be taken out of the attack for a second dangerous one? I think they pointed out on the Grade Cricketer pod that if the India fielder had dropped the ball and then run out the Australia batter, they couldn't have done a no ball check, because you can only do those after a wicket has fallen. That's the only time an umpire is allowed to do that. And so India would have won the game if the fielder had known all the rules.
That would have been some incredible thinking, some amazing foresight to drop the ball and do that. It would have been sensational.
But yeah, and then also there was debate over, or a bit of confusion over, how many runs and who should be on strike, because they weren't sure if they'd crossed or if they'd completed the run. But in the end, Australia needed 2 to win off the final ball and got that and kept the streak alive, but only for one more game.
Mm. And we all lived happily ever after.
Yeah.
Well, the good news there is that Australia are beatable ahead of the World Cup. By the time this comes out, the test will have begun. It's the first test between Australia and India in 15 years. Rachel Haynes and Harmanpreet Kaur will miss the game through injury. The weather forecast is not good. Some other Australia cricket news. The Sheffield Shield game between Queensland and Tasmania was called off after Tasmania decided to fly home after 4 COVID-19 cases were detected in the state of Queensland, which I guess is not great news for the winter ahead. Before we go on, we've been recording the podcast over the last few weeks, occasionally from Sixes Cricket Club. If you haven't heard about Sixes, Sixes Cricket Club is the new cricket-themed social entertainment venue with restaurant, bar and cricket nets. All Wisden podcast listeners can receive 10% off their food and drink by quoting Wisden10 on their booking notes. Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So mine came from the IPL, which I have to admit I haven't been watching as religiously as I was when it was originally scheduled, when there wasn't much else going on in life. But I did catch Jason Roy's first IPL game for 3 years, and he batted beautifully. He scored 60 off 42. He was essentially picked ahead of David Warner, who wasn't even invited to the ground because of restrictions about how many players you could have from your squad there. So he watched it from his hotel room whilst Roy smashed 60 off 40. And looked really good, and it just struck me. I mean, I was looking at his numbers during that innings of how he's played in T20 cricket for England this year, and his record's good, but my sense, and others might disagree, is that his star is kind of on the wane a little bit, and that there was the Roy and Bairstow combination. Bairstow seems to have kind of been elevated to another level, and if there was a player who was vulnerable in England's batting unit to someone else, it might be Roy, or more likely Milan, but actually, just watching him play just 40 balls, you just remember what a brilliant ball striker he was. And this wasn't the greatest spin attack, which is often his downfall, but you know, there was some Chris Morrison and the Fizz were bowling, so it was a decent attack to score runs against, and also just showed that he should probably have got a go a bit sooner for a Sunrisers side who have been woeful so far, and no doubt he'll play the rest of the tournament now and puts him in good shape playing at the venues that he's going to be playing for England in the World Cup. And he's looking good. And I think that's excellent news for England.
Meanwhile, our cover star can't buy a run.
Well, you know,
I'm being facetious.
He got 25 in the first game. I thought Kevin Peterson was very harsh on commentary when he said 3 failures in a row. He's like, no, it's not true. He batted all right in the first game. Simon Walsh asks, what are the panel's thoughts on the form of Owen Morgan, and should it be of concern before the T20 World Cup? Apart from a score of 41 in the 100, his next best score is 27 in his last 10 T20 games he's played, and at the time of writing, he's yet to get to double figures in the second half of the IPL. With Livingston now a dead cert to feature for England, and if Stokes was available, would Morgan's place in the World Cup team as a batsman be under threat? This is not counting, of course, Morgan's leadership qualities. But will it be time for him to move on after the T20 World Cup? It actually extends further than that. His form in the first half of the IPL was poor, and his England T20I record in 2021 is poor from a reasonable sample size. Again, Ben, I'll go to you. What do you think?
Yeah, well, in answer to the questions, what do I think of his poor form? It's poor, and should it be a concern to England? Yes. Yeah, and I think if you can kind of pinpoint the moment that the form, especially for England, switches in when Bairstow moved down to number 4, because they obviously have got to fit all those batsmen into the top 4 somehow, and then Morgan moved down to 5 and 6, and he's not quite nailed that role of finisher, but also, you know, he's of an age where you might expect to see a decline at some point, and in a format like T20 cricket where, you know, your eye is so important and being able to score from ball one is so important, those small sort of 5 percenters can make quite a big difference. I think he will, well, he obviously will keep his place for the T20 World Cup. I think there's a decent argument that he'll sort of almost push himself down the batting order, like as far as he can in a way. Like he might well, like Livingston will be England's number five, Morgan England's number six. And there might be times when if there's four balls left to bat, he'll let Curran go in ahead of him or Moeen and he'll go down to number seven. I don't think he'll have an issue with that. He has said in the past that if his form were to become an issue, he would have no issue with dropping himself. And I guess if his main strength as a captain is sort of the sort of vibe manager who is able to sort of cultivate this this aura of fearlessness around the team, maybe he can do that from off the field. I don't know, but yeah, I think it'd be very, very interesting to watch how he gets on over the next couple of months. And if he does have a poor World Cup and England don't win it, basically that could well be a sort of a neat time to say goodbye to one of England's greatest ever white ball players, I guess.
One thing to add, he has always been a very streaky player, and when he looks bad, he looks really quite bad. And it's not that long ago that we were saying he was in the form of his life. I mean, it's only 18 months ago, maybe. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if he kind of comes good at the World Cup. But it is an interesting question, and I don't think it's one that's as relevant for this World Cup, because I think he will play, and as Ben says, he can just kind of get buried down the order if the runs aren't coming. But at the end of the tournament, whether England win it or not, Morgan might have a decision to make about whether he warrants a place in this side in the medium term and whether he should stay on. And I think it wouldn't be a huge surprise if he goes at the end of the tournament, almost particularly if England win. I mean, if I was Morgan at that point, I'd think, you know, this what's left, it can't go any better than at this point. And he's not a bloke. I mean, he's going to be fine. He's not going to just play on and play on because he feels like he can't let the game go. That he's also got enough pride, I think, that he wouldn't stick around if he didn't think he was worth his place in the side. So I think this is an interesting question that's going to, really be particularly interesting over the next couple of months.
And again, I think I made this point before on the pod. There are so many global white ball tournaments now for the next literally 10 years that there's never going to be like an obvious point to kind of have your revolution and have new guy come in with loads of time before the next tournament. So I can see that happening. I can see Morgan or other big name captains kind of resigning at quite short notice. Should we get into our moments of the season? So thanks again for everyone who sent in a moments of the season. We've got our own here in the office. Phil, do you want to go first?
What are you asking me? Moment of my season?
Yes.
Can I have two?
Yeah.
I'll be brief.
I'm sure.
All right. Noted. Both oval based. I'm very parochial. The first one was back in whenever it was, July, the first rollout of the 100 here, 7,000 punters in for the Oval Invincibles women against Manchester Originals women. And it was a belter of a game. It was on BBC. It was on Sky as well. Many tuned in, including a friend of mine, good friend of mine, who has never... She's a woman who never showed any interest in the game before. And she was texting me and asking me questions about what was going on. And the fact that it was on the BBC conferred significance and legitimacy straight away. You know, she goes out with a lad who's a big sports fan, right? So Sky Sports is a part of her life. But to have it on the BBC changed the outlook straight away. It was a really good game of cricket. The Invincibles won it with a couple of balls to spare. Maddie Villiers, who is a kind of coming star and a charismatic young cricketer and a good talker. She gave a great interview afterwards. She kind of won the game with Dane van Nieuwkerk. And so it was good kind of good mix of legend overseas, up and coming young English player. Everyone looked like they were enjoying it. It was a very unpretentious kind of atmosphere here at the Oval. And I think anybody who was hoping that it was going to fail, hoping that no one was going to turn up and it was going to be a dud, I think they've got their for all the legitimate concerns that we've talked about 1,000 times and will continue to, and they're legit. Anyone who wanted that day to go wrong, I think their priorities are skewed. They can't really truly care about the English game and its future. This thing needed to go well, and on that evening, it did. And it was a rousing thing to see. Just a word on my mate. 2 weeks later, she went to Lourdes actually to see London Spirit stink the place out. But she did go to Lourdes. And she was on the ticket website that night. And, you know, I'm not saying a revolution took place that night, but it was a rousing experience nonetheless. And the other one is simply Bumrah here on the final day, taking a pitch that refused to yield all year, taking that out of the equation with one of the great spells, with the old ball cleaning up Bairstow and Pope and the rest of it. And on the one hand, kind of encapsulating India's raw brilliance, on the other kind of highlighting England's limitations. You know, England went into two London Test matches favourites, certainly if not to win, then certainly not to lose, going into the final day, lost them both, and they lost them both on the back of sustained superb brilliance by individuals. And India, for all that the year ended weird, you know, they really did, they gave us a lot this summer, and that spell will live on in my head anyway forever.
Mm. Our first listener moment of the season is quite similar to your first one. So this is from Amber Nichols. I was lucky to be at the Aegeus Bowl on a perfect summer afternoon to see Southern Brave women qualify convincingly for the 100 finals. But it was not a moment on the field of play which sticks with me. I was sat next to the players' dressing room with the men's match in full flow. The women players left the dressing room and walked out the ground around the boundary. As they went, the crowd were drawn away from watching the men and all stood, cheered and applauded the women as they left. A few weeks before, very few of that crowd would have watched the women play live or recognised any of them. Yet here was a sea change in women's cricket, with the players finally getting the praise and recognition they have so long deserved. That, for me, was the moment of the summer. A small example of the importance of this summer to women's cricket here in the UK. My daughter has never been interested in cricket, but we took her to the 100 finals and she loved it. She's just left for university and the first club she has signed up for is cricket and she is really enjoying it. Hopefully this sort of new engagement with the game is now happening up and down the country. That sums it all up.
It does, well. And it echoes a lot of the other letters in terms of tone that we've received in the last week or two. Not everybody is staring into the abyss with this game, and it's important that we remember that, I think.
Mm. James Weeks, his moment of the season is appropriately from this week. My moment was more niche but equally satisfying, and I didn't know this until he emailed this in, actually. Matt Critchley needed exactly 100 runs from the last game of the season to make 1,000 runs for the overall season. And when he was out for 85 in the first innings, all seemed lost until he was promoted to open in their chase of 23 in the fourth innings. 15 not out and 1,000 run summer for a bloke known to bowl filthy leggies. Lovely.
I actually didn't know that either. And I included it in this month's Wisden Cricket Monthly. So thanks, James, for the nod on that one.
I think he needed like 10 of their last 10 runs as well. So literally the last ball of the season, he got to exactly 1,000 with a two, which is lovely. Joe, what's your moment of the season?
Mine was back in late June at the Aegeus Bowl, and Ross Taylor and Kane Williamson knocking off the winning runs to win the first World Test Championship final. It feels like a long, long time ago already, but you know, we've done it before. It was fitting that it was those two guys that knocked off the runs. It was certainly a nice thing for my family, who haven't seen New Zealand win too many cricket tournaments or
Have
even matches over the years. Did you go and watch a bit of Essex, do you, Phil?
I'll be brief.
that was the moment for me, really.
Lovely. Here's one from Harry Bryhouse. In August, I visited my dad from the US, where I've lived for 36 years. He had tickets to a charity match for Bernardo's at Wormsley on the JP Getty estate. The day was overcast and always seemed about to rain, but maybe 300 people turned up, about 10% white, 15% black, and the vast majority Britons of Pakistani descent, many with connections to Birmingham, where my dad was for a long time the chief education officer and a relentless but subtle champion of multiculturalism. Chris Lewis captained one side and the CEO of Bernardo's, Javed Khan captained the other. To be honest, the cricket was nothing to write home about. Before the teams took the field, Peter Oborne, who was playing for one of the teams, gave a short speech explaining that although a good number of the players weren't confident that they would ever be able to get up again, both teams would take the knee before the game because racism has no place in cricket or in the world. I live in the country which brought taking the knee to the world, but in which the simple and fussy way that Oborne spoke the truth would be impossible in any setting.
That is a great, great letter. Mm. Who was the chap again?
Harry Bryhouse.
Thank you for that, Harry. That's brilliant. It's lovely to hear.
A couple more. David Shervington said, "This is the one that you shared on Twitter.
Sherbo.
I'm a very, very fresh cricket fan, converted in a moment of radiant clarity a few years ago while painting the garage door and listening on the radio to Alistair Cook in his final test. Since then, I've been to see everything from county championship and one-day cup matches to an ODI and a couple of 100 matches, and have always come away smiling. But my moment of the summer, first day, fourth test at the Oval, at the age of 35, having avoided the sport for most of my life, my first ever live test match, a beautiful day of ebb, flow and many wickets. And the exact moment I'll be thinking about all winter, Bumrah running into Burns in bright sunshine at the start of the England innings that afternoon, the sound of the ominous Barrett Army, drums booming across the ground and mixing with the balmy army trumpet a few feet away to our left playing Jerusalem. I'm very grateful to have found cricket. George O'Brien says, my moment of the summer is simply reading Felix White's book, It's Always Summer, somewhere, on a lake in Canada and trying to explain why I was crying with laughter and sadness about cricket, indie music and dealing with grief. Ben, what's yours?
So mine is from something, but also back in July, that feels absolutely ages ago, but the Ben's Babes ODI series win against Pakistan, when it looks at that point like the summer might sort of all kind of collapse in on itself, when that notification comes through that England have had to replace their entire squad because of a COVID outbreak, and then they put together this sort of haphazard, slapdash, sort of ragtag bunch of nobodies. England are so strong white ball cricket that it would never be that way. And they ended up sort of cruising the first two games, and then the third game was a classic. And my actual moment is the 100 for James Vince, which just felt like he might not play much more for England, might not play again for England, but it felt like he deserved that moment for all his promise, for everything he's done in county cricket, for how good he looks sometimes. And that was just a wonderful, he'll always be able to say, James Vince, England centurion. And it was just a very heady, strange sort of few days, that ODI series. And that was a wonderful moment to cap off, and in front of a crowd who was sort of cheering everything on and absolutely loving it up in Edgbaston as well. So that was just a great, weird series win and a wonderful moment for Vince.
Quietly, Vince has actually had an impressive summer, hasn't he, really? When you met that knock, he's obviously captain Southern Braves to win the 100. He took, surprisingly, a Hampshire side, which aren't that strong in T20 cricket, to finals day. And he got a decent championship runs as well. I think it's actually been a really good year that slightly slipped under the radar.
They nearly won the championship. We probably should have spoke longer about them earlier on, but if they beat Lancashire, they would have won it.
Yeah, and he played a brilliant innings in that game, because no, it was low scoring game, no one made above 50, and he sort of strummed it. he made a gorgeous 69 alongside Liam Dawson, who added 40, and at that point it looked like Hampshire would bat Lancashire out of the game, and then it wasn't to be.
But it was
exactly it was James Vince.
Using that 100, it's a great example. It's perfect Vincian fare, isn't it? That in some ways the real poets out there, I'm looking at John Hotton and the rest, they kind of don't want him to play for England anymore, because it's just such a perfect way to finish with an elusive 100 out there in a game that he shouldn't have even been playing in. That's perfectly Vincian.
Mm. Angus Carnegie Brown's moment this summer, I think, is from the day of your wedding, but his moment this summer is not wedding.
Not actually Phil's wedding.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for someone to write about this.
Apparently not Phil's moment either. So.
Having watched a relatively indifferent but still Test cricket day on the Friday, we returned on the Saturday at Trent Bridge to watch England's inevitable collapse. As everyone knows, Joe Root scored the most incredible impish 100 and not far off a runner ball to put England past respectable and into competitive territory. As we assessed the majesty of what we had seen and discussed what the next day might bring, we were buoyed by the sight of Ravichandra and Ashwin doing laps around the boundary and the reminder of the fact that this giant of the game was not on the side. In many ways, it was a snapshot of the summer. Utterly crazy, enthralling, everything that Test cricket is. And finally, Daniel Gibson's is, highlight of my cricket year is watching my son complete his first season at Stockbridge under nines, especially seeing him take his first ever wicket, a lovely caught and bowled. The ECB doesn't always get things right, but the All Stars cricket programme has been doing great things for kids in getting them into cricket, and seeing the increase in numbers year on year at the club has been fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that's praise and fair praise as well. It's not just that, the Dynamo's schemes as well have been bedded down this summer more than ever before, obviously, with COVID issues in previous summers. So yeah, look, in amongst the brickbats and the vitriol and the bile that's been lugged their way of late, much of which is probably deserved,
In this instance, more people are playing cricket than they have been in a number of years, and that's a fact. That is a fact.
Absolutely. And my moment of the summer is Haseeb Ahmed's 50 after everything he's gone through in the last 4 years, but also that first ball at Lord's. I think for him to get that moment in a home test match 4 or 5 years almost since his test debut, I thought was very, very special.
Good shout.
And just to reiterate what we said earlier, we're genuinely very thankful for the considerable time so many of you clearly took to send in your emails over the past week. Some very kind words about the show. If you want to send in anything longer than a tweet, do get in touch at podcast@wisden.com. We do our best to get back to every single email. That's all we've got time for today. Cheers, Ben. Cheers, Joe. Cheers, Phil. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends, and we'll be back next week.
Podcast Network.